the Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 94, we discuss UEFA Nations League and whether we love it or hate it, our memories of Peter Brackley, who sadly died this week, how the UK's Saturday blackout ruling has hurt 11 sports, and we have a bunch of letters from you listeners in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnire. Now, Kartik, from this past week, even though it was an international break, we got a ton of feedback from the listeners on all sorts of points we raised last week, as well as some questions. But we'll get to that a little bit later in the podcast. For those listeners who have never had a chance to hear the show before and giving it a chance for the first time, what we do is we dive deep into the everything from the soccer TV production to the online streaming options that are out there, the commentators, the highs and lows. But basically, for kind of really hardcore soccer fans who want to enjoy watching the games, we give everything from tips to insight to analysis about watching the beautiful game. And we're here every week on every Thursday. Now, Kartik, from this past week, and this is a request from Trevor Hood, one of our listeners, he wanted to know what was your and my favorite game of the week, and if we can continue doing that each week when we're talking about what we've been watching. So I'll kick it off with you, Kartik, and what was your favorite match that you watched this past week?
It was probably Netherlands-Germany on Saturday, which was a decisive Dutch win. I would say the reason it was my favorite game is I just really liked what I saw from the Dutch team who have been lacking the last few weeks, last few years. And we've been waiting, all of us around world football, to see if and when they would bounce back. We're so used to the Dutch playing a certain style of football and also being near the top of the world game. And they're not back yet. But this match was certainly a statement of intent, and I really enjoyed watching the play of two players in particular. Georgia Wijnaldum, who's had a fantastic start to a season at Liverpool, and obviously had a very good season last season for Liverpool. And so Georgina Wijnaldum is one player, and then Memphis Depay, who has been playing at an exceptional level in Liga 1, but now that has translated to essentially – having to be the creator. He's playing, we're in an era, Chris, where guys who are wingers are playing as kind of hybrid wingers number 10s and number 9. So he's basically a 7, 10, and 9 rolled into one. And that shows with the Dutch team, where he's got a lot of space to operate, particularly when Germany has the ball and gives the ball away. And it was just a fun game to watch.
One of the challenges I've had so far with the UEFA Nations League is that there's oftentimes, I mean, a lot of the games are kicking off at the same time. I mean, not always, but most of them are. So for the Germany games, I've been wanting to watch Germany play this past week, but there's always been another game on that I'm watching instead. So in regards to Germany's performances, Kartik, and their run of form, which has been really poor of late, is it that, I mean, this German team is falling apart, or is it just that the opposition they're coming up against is that much better?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of both. Obviously, I thought they played decently against France on Tuesday, it was now that I think back. They are missing Mesut Ozil. I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, but they don't have that player in midfield who has a certain degree of guile and an ability to control the tempo of the match and play a probing ball in to a number nine. And obviously they have problems at the striker position, and they're not getting the kind of production. For a long time, Germany survived with production from guys who were not out-and-out strikers scoring goals, Podolski, Thomas Müller, and others. They're not getting that anymore. And I have to say, I think there's a combination of players, Draxler, Müller, Boateng, Hummels, who are way off their previous form. And we saw that with all four guys in the World Cup. We've seen that now in the Nations League. Yogi Löw has a lot of talent at his disposal. I think he saved his job with the performance in Paris, it appears like. If they had gone out, they'd been beaten soundly the way they were in Amsterdam, he would have been out of the job. Now I think for November, he's just got to refresh the squad, there is going to be increasing calls for more young players. Germany has no shortage of talent. This is not a situation like the Dutch, and especially the Italians. The Italians, if you looked at the Italian player pool a year ago, you could see why they missed the World Cup. They just had incredible deficiencies in a number of positions on the pitch. And if you looked at Serie A, the vast majority of good players in Serie A are foreigners. That's not the case in the Bundesliga and with Germany. So it's perplexing, and I know it's the talking point that everybody is discussing coming out of this Nations League, this international break, but I think they've got the talent at their disposal to turn this thing around. That it may be too late in this group. The Dutch just need one more point to stay up, and the French are probably going to win the group. But Germany needs to look towards Euro 2020 and not being embarrassed the way they were at this last World Cup.
So my favorite game of this past week, Kartik, had to be Spain against England. This reminded me of one of the better matches from like the early rounds of the 1982 World Cup, which I know for a lot of listeners is going way, way back. But the level of football in this one was fantastic. It was you had everything. You had full-blooded tackles. You had two teams that were definitely playing at a high level. You could tell that this was not a meaningless friendly. This was meaningful. This was a great game. England, the first half, were absolutely incredible. Harry Kane, of course, at the center of that, but also Ross Barkley. Ross Barkley has really been this season a revelation, really, I think, for Chelsea. I mean, he looks fitter. He looks more, even for Chelsea, too.
He's a manager and system.
He looks like a new man. He looks like a new player, and he really played his part in this game. And then the second half, Spain bounced back. I mean, it was Spain had most of the possession, of course, in this game, but they really pushed England. And it was Paco Alcacer, the Borussia Dortmund player, pulled a goal back from a beautiful header. He's been scoring goals like crazy. That was a joy to watch. But a really, really good game, and thoroughly entertaining. And I posted something on Twitter, too. I think I said, what a difference this game made. Because if you asked me on probably Monday morning what I thought about UEFA Nations League, I would probably have said, for the most part, been disappointing. But this one game has turned me and making me look more positive at the UEFA Nations League as a whole in terms of just the level of football that's being played. This was absolutely fantastic. Now, on the Friday game, though, Kartik, hopefully you didn't see this, but the Croatia-England game was one of the dullest games I've ever seen in my entire life. It was played in front of an empty stadium because of a ban on the Croatian supporters, which unfortunately meant that the away supporters couldn't be there too. And it felt like it was watching a scrimmage game. It was really, horrible to watch. I mean, no atmosphere. And I think it affected the players too, because it was just a debacle. It was just absolutely horrible to watch. Now, Kartik, I want to get your thoughts, though, too, I mean, on the UEFA Nations League so far, whether you love it or hate it. What do you think thus far?
I'm neutral about it. I mean, I don't hate it. I actually like the concept and really believe in the idea. And I think long-term in football, we need maybe more of this and less direct cup competitions and less friendlies. However, the thing I don't like is coming off a World Cup. I think that the human body can only take so much. And there are a lot of players that just look tired, that played in a World Cup over the summer, that then turn around, European club season starts, then they have these international breaks, and you're throwing competitive matches into these international breaks. Now, in fairness, going into after the 2014 World Cup and the 2010 World Cup, the initial batch of European qualifiers for the next Euros were similar, with kind of tired players, guys who were not performing at a peak level. So I just think the calendar is too congested. I actually like the concept. I like the idea a lot and have been keeping up with it. It's just that with the absence of a winter break in a lot of these leagues, a true winter break, I know people will say, oh, well, Serie A has a winter break. No, they really don't. Okay, they take a weekend off. That's it. And Spain's winter break has gotten shorter and shorter as well. So it's only really Germany of the big league. Same thing with France. It's a short break. Mm-hmm. I just think that players are breaking down, and we see in the matches between the better nations. Okay, Spain, England being an exception. We see a lot of tired legs. We see a lot of slow movement. Now, the thing I do like, Chris, I have to point this out, is because I've been watching this program on Univision that they have, this Nations League program. So I'm seeing clips from every game. And then obviously ESPN FC shows a lot as well. The matches between the likes of the Faroe Islands and Liechtenstein and Gibraltar, they have been very entertaining. From what I can see. So I think it's one of these things where if you don't qualify for World Cup and you don't have players that are really tired or are playing at the elite clubs in Europe, the performance level, the urgency, it's all there like any kind of competitive international. And that I love, because there's something potentially for those countries to win, which is promotion to the next next league. Or, in fact, in some cases, one of them is going to end up in the Euros based on this convoluted Euro qualifying that comes out of the Nations League. One or two of them might end up in the Euros. So Kosovo is another one I've enjoyed seeing. But for the big countries, it's been a little bit of a chore, honestly.
Yeah, it's been hit or miss. I mean, some of the games have been good. Some of the games have been pretty drab and boring. But what I do like about it, I mean, two things I like about it. One is the competitive side of things, where, like you said too, the Gibraltars are playing Liechtenstein. And normally in kind of World Cup qualifying in Europe, you've got a group that has England, I mean, I don't know, Germany, Portugal, and Gibraltar or something like that, or Liechtenstein. And those minnows have absolutely no chance. And it really is a very one-sided game. So with the UEFA Nations League, with those games being more competitive, a lot of the games I watched this week were Wales playing, like Wales against Ireland, Wales against Denmark a few weeks ago, but a lot of games that were very on a similar level in terms of the countries, and that I enjoy. The other part of it I enjoy is the whole promotion relegation. I mean, these games, there's a lot on the line in terms of the teams moving up and down the ladders, and now going into the next couple of games, it's going to get, I think it's going to get better and better as fans, and also as the players, I'm sure, realize what's at stake and how they could get moved up or moved down the league within the UEFA Nations League. I like it. I like the concept of it, and so far it's been good. Not all the games have been wonderful by any means, but it's better than what the international break is usually. Now, speaking of the international break, usually, Kartik, so the USA-Colombia game was last week on the Thursday. Unfortunately, I missed that one because I was at my kids' soccer practice, but I came back, switched it on, and joined the post game, so I was able to kind of watch a little bit of that. What I did notice, which is really not surprising, really, is that, I mean, of course, I come back, switch on the TV, see that the US had lost, I think 4-2, I think it was, and went on to Twitter for a second, which is probably a mistake, and saw just all the abuse and just all the negativity about the performance, and then listened to Rob Stone and Marisa Du and Alexi Lalas. And it was all, and also whoever the, I think it was Jenny Taft or whoever the sideline reporter was. And everything was very positive. A lot of positive questions, a lot of like, hey, what do we take from this game? What did we learn? Even the questions they asked, I think Dave Sarakan, were very positive. No negativity at all. Until towards the end, when Lalas said, hey, I hate to be kind of the curmudgeon, but we're not really learning anything from this. And it's 12 months since since the disaster in Trinidad and Tobago, and we still don't have a coach. And it was interesting because, I mean, Fox, we know we've talked about this for a couple of years at least, the rah, rah, rah. And we saw this. And it was interesting for me. Rob Stone seemed angry. He seemed, I don't know if it was...
Well, he didn't like the crowd being 80 or 90% Colombian, I guess.
Yeah, and he's from Tampa.
Right, he's from Tampa. But they put the game in Florida for a reason. I've been saying this for a month, or 6 weeks, since Tampa had been announced as the venue, that we knew why the game was being played here. And I have to just a bone to pick with all the Twitter fandom that has gone after this stake in the wake of this match. Do you want known U.S. games to be played in this state against countries from Central America or South America. Now, obviously, Orlando had a very partisan U.S. crowd against Panama a year ago. So maybe there were exceptions. But it just seemed like there was a desire to pick on the state of Florida and pick on our diversity and the ethnic makeup of this state because this game in Tampa had been so pro-Colombian, the crowd.
It's gotten to the point, though, Kartik, where there's so few U.S. men's national team supporters coming to these games that...
Because of the ticket prices.
Right. But then Colombia has to pay the same ticket prices as the U.S. national team.
True.
So, so U.S. soccer, when they're picking these games and figuring out where to play them, it seems to be focused on the away team, whatever the away team... I mean, to bring in the most number of tickets and most number of revenue... Whether it's New Jersey for Brazil or Colombia for Florida and Peru for Hartford. I mean, it seems to be very.
That was another one. It seemed like there were more Peruvian fans.
By far. I mean, with the Peru USA game, that game I did watch, and I watched that one. At my kids' soccer practice aligned with this one, so I was able to watch this game. And this game was on ESPN. Ian Dark and Taylor Twellman enjoyed the commentary in this one. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that came out of this one. There wasn't really much to say about the game other than the one thing I did think was annoying from this game, the USA Peru game, was just the ticker on the bottom. I'm like,
yeah,
it was like it was just so distracting. This has been a problem with ESPN for many, many years. But any thoughts from the USA games, Kartik, or the coverage of the games that you wanted to point out?
Yeah, and we'll get to the U.S. women in a minute because I think that deserves merits a separate discussion. But from the men's game, look, the U.S. was just undone by a better team, and the reactions on Twitter and the reactions from Fox were kind of visceral. I feel like there is... It just a kind of desperation among the supporters and among U.S. fans. Lawless reflected that. You mentioned Lawless's comments. I think Lawless has now moved into I know a lot of people who listen to the show see him as like the chief cheerleader. I see Rob Stone in that role and Fox executives in that role. I think Lawless is now in this frustrated position that is more openly expressed by ESPN pundits, but now we're past the World Cup. We're past nations who were in the World Cup hiring new coaches and playing an additional set of friendlies with those new coaches. Why are we still where we are at? And so Lawless was reflecting, I think, the pulse of the fan base that night, whereas the rest of the Fox executives were reflecting the propaganda arm of U.S. soccer. We're acting as the propaganda arm of U.S. soccer. Let's continue to the Peru game. I think, obviously, ESPN, you get a very different approach. I was disappointed in the fact that this match was in Hartford, and I thought ESPN would pull out all the bells and whistles because it's a home game for them, essentially. And they didn't, and it was because they were confined by scheduling. Again, there's baseball playoffs going on, so they're trying to cover that in wraparound coverage. We'll talk more about the baseball playoffs when we get to the U.S. women. And then they had college football programming they were trying to shove into a primetime slot on Tuesday, which limited them to a shorter game window. So we didn't get the kind of fantastic studio banter and discussion we've gotten previously from Brados and Gomez. And Casey Keller, among others. Some good stuff on ESPN FC this week because Brian McBride's been in Bristol and Ali Moreno's been there. And he's always very well-versed in U.S. developments and can talk about it. And Seb Salazar's been hosting, and he was fantastic talking about the U.S. coaching situation when Gab Marcotti asked him. Normally it's Seb asking Marcotti the questions. Marcotti asks Seb Salazar, why isn't Jesse Marsh a candidate for this job? Jesse Marsh, those of you who follow me closely probably know that I've said if he wanted the job, he should be the only candidate for the job. But he's not even on the list, it appears, right. Despite being American, despite being a former national team player, despite being a longtime MLS player. And Salazar said very clearly, Marsh is very opinionated. He has kind of a possession-based type of football that Red Bull plays, and now he's obviously an assistant with Leipzig. And they don't want that. They don't want guys that are controversial. They want company men, more or less. But anyway, I think for me, there is And Taylor Twellman had a great rant at halftime about the Soccer Hall of Fame, which is another, I'm looking for the right word, cluster, for lack of a better term, with U.S. soccer. I think what we're seeing now, Chris, is there's a reflection among pundits outside of Rob Stone and one or two others on Fox. There is a frustration with the direction of this program that everybody panicked a year ago but tried to be supportive and said, okay, this is our moment of reckoning. Let's make the right decisions. Let's put the ship on the right course. A year later, I think you're seeing open frustration from people on air. You're seeing open frustration on Twitter from accomplished writers who I think a lot of our listeners may associate as pro-MLS or pro-U.S. soccer writers, but now have kind of flipped the narrative because we're a year on with no tangible changes to the on-field product, to the way decisions are made, to the transparency of the federation with these decisions. And you're just seeing every U.S. broadcast be filled with a degree of negativity that even I, as someone, a frequent critic of this program over the last decade or more, has become uncomfortable with. But it's the reality of where we are at. So that was ESPN's broadcast, and that was Lawless on Fox's broadcast, and that's Twitter. And if U.S. soccer wants it to change, you're going to have to make some decisions. You're going to have to make some decisions openly and credibly, and engage the stakeholders in it. Otherwise, this is just going to continue. I mean, the friendlies in November against England and Italy could be even uglier on television and on Twitter if the right changes aren't made in the next 3 weeks.
Well, that's the thing, though, too, because like what we've heard is what the U.S. soccer is going to announce the new coach in, was it early December?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that, which, I mean, everyone kind of thinks it's Greg Berhalter that'll get it. There was a report today from ESPN Deportes that said that Tab Ramos is supposed to be getting it. But, I mean, whichever one it is, I mean, it's absolutely crazy that U.S. soccer is waiting this long to make the announcement. And like you said, too, the next game's coming up against Italy and England in Europe. These are games where... I mean, the decision really needs to be made before that, and I'd be surprised if it is. It's probably going to be after that point.
No, and the thing that I don't understand is, so Dave Sarokin has been the interim coach for a year now. He keeps being given the power to try out new players. I think he's done a really good job of his selections, and he's dug deep, right? He's pulled guys out of the second division in the Netherlands, a couple guys from the championship, English-born players he's brought into the pool. He's really done a good job of expanding kind of where the U.S. looked for players, which has been a service, and I think Sarokin needs to be thanked for that. But then if he's not going to be the permanent head coach, and he's not going to be the permanent head coach, why do you continue to let him call in these teams? Because who knows? The new coach might come in and say, you know, I don't want all these guys from the championship and from – the Dutch league that you're calling in. I want to just get back to the guys that were in qualifying last year, which, you know, I hope the coach doesn't do that. But let's just say the coach wants to do that. And some of these guys haven't been called in since the Trinidad game. And you've essentially replaced the team with a lot of guys that are younger and are playing their trade abroad. And guys in MLS who are very young, not your established MLS veterans. So, unless Sarokin is involved in the direction of the program, or he's being directed to say, hey, the new coach, whoever it is, but again, we don't know who it is, wants these sorts of players looked at. Because even when Sven-Göran Eriksson had taken the Mexico job and wasn't on the job, and when Juan Carlos Osorio had taken the Mexican job and had left the management to Tuca Ferretti for a few matches before he formally took the job, I know from my sources who cover Mexican football that those coaches had input into the selection of the squads before they actually formally took the job because they had accepted the job. With the U.S., we don't know if that's the case because we don't know who the coach is. And Sarokin has been Sarokin's tenure as an interim coach is effectively longer than most full-time coaches end up managing at the international level. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
Yeah. I mean, he's molded the team his own way, which I think has been a useful service to kick the U.S. on. But if he's not going to be the coach, then maybe it's all for naught because the next coach might come in and say, oh, we really don't like this guy from Wigan you're playing at left back. We're going to go back and find a guy in MLS or something like that. You never know.
Right. All right, Kartik, before we move on, what about the U.S. women's team against Canada?
So I worked late. I got home from work and I turned on the game and what I thought was the game, and there was a baseball game going on. I said, oh, this must be a mistake. I then go to my DVR access. I said, all right, I better watch the game from the beginning. And it turned out, obviously, the U.S. had scored in the second minute. That goal held up until late, which was when the U.S. got the second goal. And I had taped the baseball game. And Fox had moved the game to FS2 without anything scrolling during the baseball game to indicate that they had moved this game to FS2, except at the very beginning when I turned my DVR on, and at 8:01 they were scrolling this, and then figured again, baseball fans don't want to be bothered with soccer, and that there's a stigma about it, so let's not reinforce to those people like me that might be tuning in late that the soccer game has been moved to FS2. Now, it was just by usual reasoning. I said, maybe it's on FS2, and it was. But it was very frustrating because it showed me again, okay, I get that it's the baseball playoffs and it gets better ratings. I don't know why the game was behind. I don't follow baseball. I have no idea. I had no idea there was a game going on at that time, at the same time as the U.S. women's game, which was, again, very annoying. But it reinforced to me when they don't put something at the bottom of the screen indicating this, that we don't matter that much in the bigger picture to them, right? Soccer fans. Now, this U.S.-Canada game was – both teams had already qualified for the World Cup based on the results over the weekend and the games that I think many of us watched. The U.S. Crushing Jamaica and Canada with Panama, or – the reverse,
right?
But the thing about this was it was still for the CONCACAF title between two countries that have a rivalry, mm-hmm. and I think the only real test, the only game worth really watching for either the U.S. or Canada in this tournament that both have blitzkrieged through was to watch this match, and I can't imagine the number of soccer fans who missed large portions of this match or missed the entire match because of this.
And if it was the other way around, if it was, a baseball game that had been moved to from FS1 to FS2, which probably would never happen, but because of soccer, you can be sure that there'd be massive tickers on the bottom.
It just was very frustrating, and I don't think Fox handled it well. Mm-hmm. As for the broadcast itself, I want to mention this. I thought the broadcast was really good. I think Fox has done a pretty good job with this CONCACAF tournament all the way through. I don't say often positive things about Fox, but I think they have. I really liked whatever Ali Wagner was wearing yesterday. It was like it was a different look. The sweater she was wearing or the shirt she was wearing for what you normally see on a broadcast, and I think it really kind of popped. And I felt like I want to see more of that. I think dress on broadcasts and on sets for soccer matches have become too conservative. Honestly, so
was it better than Carlos Bocanegra's sweater?
Yes, but it was just like a multicolor sweater, and I thought it was just really popped in halftime. And JP Della Camera, these sorts of matches remind me of why we like Della Camera. I know he gets criticized a lot for his style by purists or some soccer fans that are accustomed to more English style commentary, but when it comes to actually giving some sort of historical perspective in an important U.S. women's game, there's no one better. I don't know if John Strong can deliver the same sort of commentary in this sort of match. So I thought Della Camera and Wagner, especially last night, were really good. And again, I didn't see the first 20 minutes because and I missed Rose Lavelle's goal in real time because my DVR taped a baseball game instead.
One more thing, Kartik, and that is something I haven't done in years. I actually watched a NFL game. Well, at least part of it.
Oh, that's more than I've ever done in years.
Well, because I was playing cards with my friends, and they wanted to watch the NFL game, which was the Chargers-Patriots game on Sunday. So I had it on in the background, so I wasn't really watching it, but I would look up every so many minutes. What I saw, though, Kartik, was promos for Chelsea Man United, which was, that game had more than 21 million viewers. And I thought to myself, well, you mean, congratulations to NBC for doing that. That's definitely the type of cross promotion which we talked about recently on the podcast and in your article. That's the promotion that you don't see from other broadcasters. And so hats off to NBC for promoting the Chelsea Man United game during the Chiefs Patriots match. All right, Kartik, before we move on to the news and TV streaming segment, I do want to mention our sponsor, and that is SeatGeek. Getting tickets can be far too complicated with hundreds of sites and varying levels of reliability. It's hard to know who to trust. That's why SeatGeek is the way to go. SeatGeek pulls millions of tickets into one place, so you can easily find the seats you want for a price you're willing to pay. There's nothing quite like being there in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. By searching multiple ticket sites and grading every ticket based on value, SeatGeek helps you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to ticket source for everything from sports and concerts to comedy and theatre. I actually have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets during the last few months. I've used it this past summer to search for tickets to the International Champions Cup games for my family, for the games that were in Miami, as well as a music concert featuring my favorite rock band, The Cult. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. That's promo code WSTPOD for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Now, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news and some interesting news to kick off.
Yeah, so I know a lot of people followed 11 Sports showing matches at 3 p.m. In the UK from continental European leagues. They have assented to honor the blackout ban that has traditionally occurred at this time, but has urged soccer authorities not to leave the market to, quote, criminals, which are illegal streaming services, because 11 Sports is contending, probably correctly, that people are going to try and find a way to watch these matches anyway in the UK. Now, the reason that blackout is in place, and Chris, I think this is important for our listeners who may not realize this, who are used to getting a wealth of what is 10 a.m. Eastern time games in the U.S., whether it be from the Premier League or the Championship. No matches are aired in that time slot in the U.K., which for me has been very inconvenient. I've gone to the U.K., and I'm not going to a match, but can't watch the normal array of matches I see in the U.S. or India or other countries, Canada, at that time. But it's in place in order to protect clubs from losing fans, because remember, the game is a very localized game in the United Kingdom. There are professional clubs or clubs that are aspiring professional clubs in every town, in every neighborhood of major cities, every borough of major cities, or almost every borough. Basically, this ban has been in place to try and protect attendances and people who go to matches and protect those smaller clubs. But 11 Sports is warning, perhaps correctly, that people are going to now break the law to find streams of matches from the continent that kick off at that time.
Yeah, this one's really interesting because 11 Sports had acquired the rights to La Liga, among other properties, in the UK. And they said they agreed. They said they announced that they were going to show games, some of the games, on Facebook. So they were going to show for free to anyone on Facebook in the UK only a La Liga game. Now, the challenge that they had was that with the kickoff times, they wanted to show some of the La Liga games that were going to be shown during this 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. window in the UK, British time. And they were planning on doing it. And actually, I think as of about a week ago, they basically wanted to disregard, they couldn't care less about this regulation in the UK that says you couldn't show any football during those times. And they were going through with it. And then just within the last 24 hours, they decided to go ahead and not do that after all. I understand why it's in place, the actual regulation, which actually came from the Burnley chairman back in, I think, the 70s or maybe 60s. He was the one that decided or kind of pushed for kind of to have the blackout. What he didn't envision is where we are today, Kartik, where on a localized level, it makes sense in terms of trying to prevent people to watch their TV, watch games at home on TV, and trying to encourage them to go to their non-league teams or football league teams or whatever it may be to go watch games in person. What they didn't envision is that, for all the countries outside of the UK, so games for La Liga, games for the Bundesliga, Serie A, etc. And if you're a soccer fan and you're wanting to watch those games in the UK during those time zones, you can't. So the law, the regulation that was put in place back in the 60s or 70s made sense at that time, but is completely out of date in these days. And like 11 Sports says, what it does, it gives more power to the illegal streamers. So the legal streamers are benefiting from this. The people that are in the UK who do want to watch La Liga or do want to watch Premier League will oftentimes find illegal streams. And a lot of those illegal streams of the Premier League are NBC coverage, because all the games are covered, and or La Liga or whatever league they want to watch.
And I realize, Chris, when I go to the UK and people are talking to me about the NBC covers, the reason they know it so well is because they've been watching illegal streams. I'm not joking.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so something has to be done. I don't think anything's going to be done, though. That's the thing, though, because it's so, I don't know. I just don't see them changing it anytime soon. I'm sure that. Yeah, no, and probably 11 Sports backing off on this will. In some ways, I wish they had pushed for it to see what would have happened, but it was not meant to be. Next up, Kartik, is some sad news, and that is unfortunately the death this week of commentator Peter Brackley. Now, Peter Brackley, for some of those listeners, may not be a very familiar name. He is. Though a very familiar voice. So let me go ahead and play a little clip of his commentating a Serie A game and listen to his voice and see if you remember Peter Brackley.
Raniot, now Savicevic. Panucci had made the overlap, but look who's back there defending, Ravanelli. Really has been a feature of Juve's play this season, the commitment that they've shown, as underlined here again by Ravanelli. Now Baggio, just feeling his way back really into the senior side after his lengthy layoff. Ravanelli, Otto Viali here, looking to extend Baresi. Good shot, and Rossi down with a save.
Yeah, and there you go, that's Peter Brackley. So I think a lot of listeners will remember the voice, and for a lot of the soccer fans in the United States, Peter Brackley did a lot of the FA Cup commentaries. Oftentimes, kind of the earlier rounds, especially the third round when it'd be just one commentator. In the UK, he's better known for Serie A. He used to do a lot of the Italian soccer there. But it's someone I did not have the chance to interview or speak with. I thought of highly. I knew that he was a commentator that's been in the game for a long, long time with a long history. And also seemed like a person that was well respected within the football commentator community, and definitely sad to see him pass away this week, Kartik.
Yeah, I hadn't heard his commentary in quite some time, but I associated him always with those early round FA Cup matches, really in the 2000s. Yep. And I want to say he was the sole voice on many of those matches. I remember him calling a match, a couple of Man City matches in the mid 2000s, when the FA Cup was more important than it is now for the club, because we weren't very terribly competitive in other competitions. So his voice always carried me through those matches. And then obviously he's best known for Football Italia and the things he did to promote Serie A in the UK. In fact, I've talked to some people since his passing, and they attribute, now maybe this is the sort of tribute you get after someone passes, but they attribute the popularity of Serie A in the UK largely to his voice and his promotion of the league. Him and James Richardson to a lesser extent.
Yeah.
But he was that closely associated for those in the UK with Italian football. And a lot of people who watched Serie A in its heyday when it was absolutely the best league in the world in the late 90s, associated his voice exclusively with that league. So
you can say that. I mean, you can say the same thing too about the Bundesliga and Toby Charles. I mean, Toby Charles is still alive and kicking, but you know, it's synonymous with the Bundesliga. You mean, there's so many soccer fans in the United States that remember Toby Charles and have a love of the Bundesliga because of that one person. And just goes to show with Peter Brackley doing the commentating for Serie A. And of course, James Richardson, I mean, in outside the studio or sipping coffee in Italy, that was kind of, I mean, he had a big impact too on Serie A, the popularity of that league in the UK and around the world, really. Kartik, let's move on to the next news item.
Yeah, so Fubo TV has hit almost a quarter million subscribers, 250,000 subscribers, which is more than double the number of subscribers they had 12 months ago. And Fubo's promotions are everywhere. It's funny, Chris, this is a little commentary on this. 12 months ago, because I've had Fubo since essentially the beginning of 4 years now, I would say I have this service, and no one would know what I was talking about. They would think I was talking about Sling. Now, everybody I talk to knows about Fubo, so they're doing something right, and that shows with these numbers.
The other thing, too, is this weekend they're going to be streaming Chelsea against Man United and Huddersfield against Liverpool in 4K Ultra HD through Fubo TV. So if you do have a device that they can actually show 4K, go to the worldsoccertalk.com website, and on the homepage there's an article that goes into more detail about how you can get that to work with a free trial to Fubo.
Just a quick note on that, by the way, for those of you who have DirecTV, I was not aware of it at the time, but subsequently found out from my parents that Liverpool versus Man City was in 4K special presentation on a separate DirecTV channel. If you have 4K, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but look for that in the future also if you have DirecTV.
And the last news item is in an interview last week with Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper, Tim Howard was interviewed about the TNT UEFA Champions League coverage. And definitely check it out. The article is pretty interesting. But Tim Howard was quoted as saying, "I think soccer coverage in America gets a bit boring sometimes. Same old song and dance and same old people. What we are doing at Bleacher Report is showing another side to the players. There's a cultural side of football that people are hungry for. You see that in our coverage. We are going, we're giving them stories that they may otherwise see or may otherwise not see. It's Neymar's tattoos, and it's the fashion and all the things that surround the game." So there you go. You got Tim Howard kind of mentioning kind of the one of the reasons why Turner's coverage is different. Is they're trying to tap into more of the football culture. And in the future, we hope to have an interview with the producer of TNT's soccer coverage so we can find out more details about understanding the why and understanding why they're covering the soccer and UEFA Champions League in a different way than Fox has done, than ESPN has done, than NBC has done. So that'll be interesting to see and to hear. So that'll be coming up in the next couple of weeks on the podcast. Moving on to TV ratings, Kartik. I don't have a lot of them right now, but we'll have more at worldsoccertalk.com. Some of the numbers that came out, 299,000 viewers for the U.S. women's national team against Jamaica in that qualification match on Sunday on FS1. Just prior to that, on Thursday, I think it was the USA against Colombia men's on FS1 also, 280,000 viewers for that. So the women beating out the men on the viewership there. And then Poland against Italy on Sunday on ESPN, that one had 170,000 viewers. Kartik, as far as the metrics go, I mean, we look at attendances, we look at TV numbers. We look at, you mean, kind of just a lack of interest overall, it seems, in this U.S. men's national team, which goes back to what we were saying just earlier in the podcast, is that they need to get moving quickly in terms of having a new coach on board, because they're at the risk of losing more and more fans of U.S. soccer, of the actual men's national team, it seems.
Yeah, and I think they're also, to a certain extent, a victim of MLS expanding, because I think and I've said it's a healthy football culture. I've publicly said this, when you have people who feel their club team is more important or as important as the national team, and that was not generally the case in this country. But as MLS has expanded and USL has expanded, I think there are more and more people attached to their club team, which means the U.S. has a higher standard that they need to achieve on the international level. And why is a higher standard? I don't mean something that's impossible. I mean just the basic standard they achieved during the 2000s, right? The period from 99, from that 99 Confederations Cup through the 2010 World Cup, I think is the apex of U.S. soccer. Yeah, there was the 2006 World Cup failure in there, but generally pretty good results, generally competitive, very well respected in Europe. When I would go to Europe at the time, now the U.S. is viewed more as a joke in terms of national team play. But if they don't achieve that standard, Chris, these ratings are going to continue to plummet. This is an alarming number. This 280,000 from Fox. Mm-hmm. The Univision number is very good, but I think that's a lot of Colombian fans, Colombian American fans watching.
For sure.
And then there was also a lead into Mexico, Costa Rica, which was on immediately after. In fact, the Mexico, Costa Rica match kicked off before USA, Colombia ended. So I think that's a lot of Mexico fans also continuing on to watch Mexico, Costa Rica. That 280,000 number is incredibly alarming. And I think that has more to do with the general feeling about this player pool and the lack of a coach, the lack of direction. And quite frankly, a U.S. soccer federation that I've said it for many years, you've said it for many years, but now I think more and more fans realize it, is much more concerned with finances and the economic bottom line than any sporting consideration. The sporting considerations only matter if it makes them money.
Right.
So I think that the fan base is very jaded and ratings are going to continue to plummet, which potentially, when we get to the renegotiation window, which begins in 2021, I understand, for the next TV contract. So we're only 3 years away. It's before the World Cup in 2022.
Right.
Yes, could affect that price. And we know that they're bottom line driven. So maybe that's the incentive to improve the product.
Yeah, but then you look at the 2026 World Cup and you go, you mean US being in that competition and then all the games, all the qualification. Well, actually, no. I guess in terms of that, they'll be automatically qualified to play in the
tournament. Well, we don't know that yet.
That's
true. Probably will be.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
We don't know the format
Going back to what you said, Kartik, in previous years, I think we've talked about the most popular club team in the United States, club soccer team in the United States, was the US men's national team.
Correct. Yeah.
Although, of course, they're not a club team, but the way that fans, followed and really immersed themselves in the national team was very much like a club team, very much like almost like a Manchester United supporter. That you're just really passionate, and that's something that I think in the past, 2 years, 3 years, is U.S. men's national team soccer fans have lost belief in the team. You go back for the last decades, and U.S. soccer fans were passionate and believed in the men's national team.
Your point is so well taken. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I have to mention this. During the hexagonal in 2009, qualification for the 2010 World Cup, I talked, and we were doing a separate show through World Soccer Talk at the time called Major League Soccer Talk, which focused on MLS. But then we were hearing from fans constantly during league play between the international breaks. Hey, the U.S. national team is my club team. What about the next break? I'm having withdrawal. We just had two qualifiers. We have two more qualifiers in the next break. How are the national team guys doing? And to the point where, if you remember on that show, Chris, we began focusing more on the U.S. team, even though it was branded an MLS show. And we ended up focusing more on the player pool because the majority of U.S. top U.S. players at the time were playing in Europe, unlike now. Although I think that's starting to happen again now, to where we were focusing on European football and specifically how the Americans were playing because the audience was treating the U.S. men's national team as their club team.
Yep.
Absolutely the case a decade ago or when we were doing that show, which was a decade ago.
That was, 2006, 2007, 2008. So some formative years for the growth of the game in this country. But, good points, Kartik. Let's move on to listener mailbag. We've got first up is JP, and this is in regards to the podcast talking about Turner's coverage of the Champions League. He says, maybe Turner is finally learning. While watching the Celtics game on TNT this week, I noticed that they were doing some in-game promotions for the UEFA Champions League. The ALCS coverage on TBS also has a lot of promotions, for Bleacher Report Live in general, but not specifically UEFA Champions League. Alexander says this is in regards to the Liga MX Major League Soccer possible merger. I like the idea of a North American soccer Super League. I even more like the idea of a European Super League. Basically, end the UEFA Champions League, have a UEFA Super League that adds the top teams from each league, similar to the Champions League now, to the Euro Super League 1. The next lower clubs in the standings go to the Euro Super League 2, etc. The teams then play matches around the same time as they play UEFA Champions League games. However, there is no group stage, just regular league play between Europe's most coveted clubs. At the end of the season, the top four clubs play in a two-leg semifinals and then a final. I feel that would produce a lot more intense matches between similarly skilled clubs. Kartik, any thoughts on that one?
I mean, I don't like the UEFA Super League idea because I think it's a pretense of trying to pull big clubs out of their domestic leagues and close the league off.
Yeah.
So that's my objection to it. I know there are a lot of people in the U.S. who like it. I mean, it could be to the point where we would be less offended by closed leagues if they do this, and we're conditioned to open leagues now.
Yeah.
But I'm not a fan of the idea.
Yeah, to me, the Champions League is the European Super League in a different format, but it's a similar. I mean, we already have it in many ways. I mean, if you want to watch, I mean, the UEFA Champions League for a lot of people is bigger than, say, the Bundesliga, bigger than Serie A. It's in terms of the importance of that tournament. So it's almost at that point anyway where that becomes the priority for a lot of soccer fans. Put more emphasis on that. On winning the UEFA Champions League than they would say necessarily kind of a title in that country, whichever country you're looking at. Paul Scanling says, I finally got to listen to the latest episode. I still don't understand how combining leagues helps Mexico. Their ratings are already the highest. I'm not sure it really helps Major League Soccer playing against much superior competition with resources they're unwilling or unable to match. Travel costs go up. Regional rivalries go down. What's the benefit? Major League Soccer thinks they will benefit in what way? Increased ratings and sponsorships? I doubt it will offset the increased costs of trying to compete with Liga MX's teams. This is just another example of American soccer trying to reinvent the wheel. It ain't broke, but we are desperately trying to fix it. And for what? Power? Prestige? Just another stupid idea. What I would say with Liga MX or Liga MX, depending on your pronunciation, is that I think what they have to gain is really more on the sponsorship, on the revenue side of things, on the business side of things, which they look at Major League Soccer and go, okay, well, the league's, in terms of the quality level, is not as good as Liga MX. You look at that CONCACAF Champions League as one example. But the way that they do business and the way that they're able to work with major U.S. companies in terms of sponsorships and revenue, that works. And it's like a machine. It works very well. And I think that's what Liga MX is looking at, to say, okay, hey, let's work together on this. Maybe you can help us generate more revenue for these Mexican brands. And with some working with the Mexican national team and working with the U.S. men's national team to promote these games and all the other marketing side of the things. In many ways, it's a good fit to have Liga MX work closely with some and Major League Soccer to increase revenues, if that's what their priority is, which they're businessmen, so I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it's all about sponsorship. They cite the TV numbers, they talk about that, but it's all about Liga MX and Mexican clubs getting greater sponsorships and having some sort of united might to counter the popularity among corporate executives and potential advertisers of European football. But I don't know that it'll work either. I share a lot of Paul's skepticism, although I know that the reason they're pushing this is exclusively about sponsorship.
Addition by Relegation says, on the podcast, I'm one of those who don't really watch the pre- or post-match show during the week. I'm lucky if I'm able to catch the game at all, and I consume most of my analysis from podcasts like yours throughout the week. Keep up the good work. And last but not least, Kelly Outlaw says, NBA on TNT would get crushed by soccer. Let me say that again. NBA on Twitter would get crushed by would get crushed by soccer Twitter because the pregame show is fun, lighthearted, and doesn't take itself so seriously all the time. I'm a huge fan of soccer, but sometimes they need to get the stick out of their butt. Kartik, what do you think about that one?
Yeah, I can kind of see it both ways, because I think the TNT NBA studio has become is very lighthearted, as Kelly says, and very very much into kind of like pushing cultural buttons and being edgy. They don't really analyze the games in a straightforward manner, whereas we as soccer fans are accustomed to more kind of tactical analysis, more in-depth breakdown of matches. Maybe it's because there's less less bumper soccer programming on American television that when we get some, we feel like we need to make the most out of it. I think that's part of it. My complaint about the basketball studio with TNT has also been when they shift those guys to college basketball for the NCAA tournament, they don't seem to know very much about what's going on in the college game. And I don't know if they're as poorly informed with the NBA. I'm guessing they're not. But that kind of was a harbinger for me as to how they would handle soccer, is that, you know, a lot of times they don't know about these clubs. Now, actually, what we found with the TNT studio, Chris, in soccer, in Champions League, is that they do know about the clubs, but they really don't want to talk much about it. They want to talk about these other things that Tim Howard referenced. And both ways, I think there might be a market for that. And I think perhaps the people on soccer Twitter are the same people watching ESPN FC every night, and they're getting the analysis anyway from a different network. So yep, maybe Turner is appealing to another audience.
Yeah, I would say that for TNT, I don't envy the challenge that they have in front of them. So part of it is determining who are they targeting when they have these pre-game and post-match coverage, the analysis and discussion, etc. Are they targeting the diehard soccer fans who are already consuming the product, or are they trying to reach out to a new audience that may not have watched soccer that much and try to bring them in that way? At the end of the day, it all comes down to the numbers, and the numbers will show whether or not it's working in terms of targeting these folks. And it's still too early to tell. But again, hopefully we'll have an interview with the TNT producer, the producers of the soccer coverage, to get some insight into their thinking and why they're going about things a certain way. Now, listeners, you can always reach us through email, through web at worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter at worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post comments at worldsoccertalk.com. We'd love to get your feedback. We'd love to get your opinions. We'd love to get your questions or advice, whatever it may be, and we'd love to read those out on air. All right, Kartik, coming up this week, we go back into the international break is over. Got some big games coming up, thankfully, and it should be interesting to watch. So for listeners, if they want to find out your latest analysis or thoughts or rants or raves, where can they find you on Twitter?
Yeah, just check me out at KKFLA737, and you can jump wherever from there.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. And Kartik, heading into another busy weekend, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.